Today on The Novelizers. From Bob's Burgers, John Benjamin. From Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Christina Chong. Plus Will Hines and intern Kevin Carter. Now here's your host, Andy Richter.
Hi, I'm your host, Andy Richter. You know and love me from TV, but my true lifelong passion is great literature. Not reading it. Oh, God, no. Creating great literature as much and as quickly as possible. And now I've discovered a totally painless way to do it. Everyone knows that the book is always better than the movie, but what about movies that aren't based on books? Believe it or not, some of the greatest movies of all time, Ghost, Dirty Dancing, Weekend at Bernie's, did not start out as books, which we see as a golden opportunity to reverse engineer those movies into books. And because those movies are so awesome, the books based on them are guaranteed to instantly become some of the greatest literature ever written. That's literature physics, people! So we've taken some of our cinematic faves, split them into chapters, and recruited today's greatest living writers, specifically the ones who follow me on Twitter. Then we gave each of them a simple assignment. Use your big writer brain to convert those scenes into USDA grade A literature. Now, of course, since only nerds read books, we're turning that literature into a podcast recorded by today's finest thespians of stage and screen, once again, specifically those who follow me on Twitter. We call ourselves The Novelizers. This season on The Novelizers, we're tackling a movie with everything you need in a soon-to-be classic piece of literature. Space battles, mind-controlling ear slugs, planet-destroying science projects, and Bill Shatner. I'm talking about the great film Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, written for the screen by Jack B. Sowers and written for the podcast by The Novelizers. Our first chapter was written by Ross Powell and narrated by Christina Chong, who stars as La'an Noonien Singh on Star Trek Strange New Worlds, now streaming on Paramount Plus. Christina Chong, engage.
Chapter 1, The Period. Novelized by Ross Powell, narrated by Christina Chong. This story takes place in space. It's the uppermost and largest part of the sky, extending from the atmospheric stratum that holds blimps all the way up to the celestial sphere that holds rainbows. And our story takes place in the future. But instead of a polluted police state where it rains all the time, like you're programmed to expect, it's a post-scarcity utopia where people dip out to distant worlds for the most frivolous of reasons, and it's never raining because it's in space. But there are still rainbows because it's below the celestial sphere that holds rainbows. Remember? So you can just look up and see them without blimps in the way. It's nice. Our scene opens on an explosion of metal called the Enterprise, festooned with rockets and frisbees on struts at all angles. This guy we know, Mr. Sulu, is at the helm. He controls a row of steering wheels marked pitch, roll, yaw, and inside out, and he gets to honk the horn. Our old friend Lieutenant Uhura is on comms. She enforces parliamentary rules of order over the radio and adds digital effects like autotune and reverb. And grumpy old Mr. Spock is our science officer. He keeps events on the bridge from becoming fantasy fiction. Spock is an alien from the planet Vulcan. He looks like Count Chocula from the cereal but has green blood instead of chocolate milk. Maybe you know those guys already, but check your rage when we get to the part about the captain. It's some rando named Lieutenant Savick, goddammit. But sit down, you like where this goes. No sooner do we meet our crew than they receive a distress call. Uhura puts it on the speakers and it goes, "We're the Kobayashi Maru and we ran into a ghost." Ghosts live in space. The hull came off and our pilot got chased out the airlock and his lungs went everywhere. Then Uhura says, "Can you give us your location?" And the guy says, "Wait." And then there's the sound of him looking through an astrolabe out the window. "I'm directly north of a meteor that looks like a chicken," he says. And everyone's like, "Oh, man." And Savick says, "That's in the neutral zone." And she doesn't call it the stupid or shitty neutral zone. but you can still tell she hates that place. "Computer, what kind of spaceship is a Kobayashi Maru?" says Sevik. "It's a hospital ship and a disaster evacuation ship and a subsistence farming essential supplies freighter barely welded together. It carries 40 million grams of fragile passengers and a regular complement of babies that never done nothing to no one," says the computer. Now Sevik says a sweary version of neutral zone. She chooses the word fucking. And then, "Sulu, plot a course to rendezvous. Transporter room, stand by to beam survivors aboard." One of the things hanging off the Enterprise on some or other strut is a giant observatory used for taking MRI images of people on the surface of a planet when the Enterprise is in orbit around that planet. It then 3D prints a copy of the person on board the Enterprise, who is pretty much just as good as the original person, and then melts the original person into neutrinos with a lightning gun so there aren't two identical people running around the ship doing twin scans. This is called a transporter. It also deletes any gonorrhea and intestinal gas from the copy person, but, you know, sometimes the hydrogen cartridge runs low and the resulting person is all dehydrated and has to drink a glass of gonorrhea to get better. So Sevik's plan is to use that thing to rescue the survivors and then GTFO. Of course, you know, they don't get 2 minutes in before there's a Romulan bird of paradise racing to intercept and two bleeding hog-class cruisers, and leave us not to forget, a giant moon-sized Romulan war moon closing in. So Sevik is entirely livid. The warships start laying into the Enterprise with anti-healing guns and torpedoes with sharks in them, loud watery explosions and chewing sounds below decks. The workplace camera that records events on the bridge twists clockwise and then counterclockwise as the crew hold onto their consoles, and all these boxes of artificially scarce non-fungible assets start spilling out the side of the Enterprise where the hull is breached. They're Sevik's, and now that nothing is naturally scarce, they're indescribably expensive. She'll grieve later. "Engine room damage report," she says. Montgomery Scott answers through the intercom. "You can hear other people through the comm yelling that they're on fire. Ah, my leg's burning. Now my head's burning." Like that, but just with more emotion. "Both of the engine struts fully snapped off, Captain," says Scotty. "The engines were put on struts because antimatter smells so bad and because the computer's speech recognizer has trouble with the phrase internal engines. But on the downside, they keep breaking off and jeopardizing the mission. You can hear someone further from the intercom saying very loudly, 'Computer, put internal engines on the shopping list.' And then there's an unintelligible computer voice, and then the same person says, 'Computer, take turtle penguins off the shopping list.'" "Switch to reserve power and charge phasers," says Sevik. "Open a chat to the Romulans and tell them, 'Rude, frowny face, we're on a rescue mission.'" They're jamming off frequencies," says Uhura. Sulu interrupts. "The Romulans are coming around again. The War Moon is firing its main weapon." "Evasive action," says Sevik, grasping the arms of her chair. "Everybody hope they miss." A bunch of guide beams come on in front of the War Moon, and the rest of its lights go dim for a second, and the back part expands and then contracts, like in cartoons of a cat throwing up, and a big squirt of superheated exotic matter comes out of the front gun port. It's the opposite of both normal matter and antimatter. But it misses the Enterprise and blows up a Saturn. "Good hoping, everyone," says Sevik. But then the other ships take their combat turn and destroy the Enterprise's phaser emitters, defensive shields, and food stores, and set its life support system on fire with the area of effect damage. "Okay, this mission is a hog's head full of pig shit," says Sevik. "Prepare life pods and send out a log beacon. All hands abandon ship." Then there's smoke, lots of smoke. "Computer, end simulation," said Spock. He cleared his throat and folded up his armor and damage tables and put away his dice. Vulcans experienced gastric distress when lying, and this included role-playing. Sulu leaned out the porthole and told the Romulans to go home. The smoke cleared and the bridge lights came back on. Admiral William Shatner and his friend Dr. Steve McCoy were sitting in the observation area taking turns petting a tribble. "Any advice, Admiral?" asked Sevik. "When I did it, I cast healing spells on the Enterprise hull," said Shatner. "What?" said Sevik. She looked deeply confused. "They're aren't spells. Shatna just stared at her, smugly. She side-eyed him. Permission to speak candidly for 4 minutes, sir.
Granted, said Shatna.
This test is whack and bonk. It's completely impossible. The bad guys attack immediately. They blow off both our engines on the first shot and set fire to literally everyone in engineering. And then they annihilate all the matter in a 4-light-year radius with the actual Death Star from Star Wars until we eventually necessarily explode. What the fuck is that?
Okay, but did you like the part where the guy uses an astrolabe? He elbowed her.
I did not. She started counting on her fingers. First of all, you don't look through an astrolabe, you look through a sextant. Did you spend 20 years as a starship captain without learning what a sextant is? And then why would he use this archaic thing that depends on the position of a star and the horizon of a planet when he's billions of miles away in deep space? Why doesn't he use normal sensors or just his eyes? And why is he north of something when he's in space? Did you put a bunch of jokes into a test that I'm guaranteed to fail and then think I would be amused by them?
Okay, I think you're abusing your permission to speak candidly.
I still have 2 more minutes, said Savick, and went into a tirade about Sulu yelling out a porthole at another spaceship. Do you even know what space is or how sound works?
Sulu did that in real life after the simulation ended, said Shatna.
Look, the point of the test is to give you practice with failure. How we deal with death is at least as important as how we deal with life. Now, go off and think about that. Savick left, and McCoy patted Shatna on the shoulder.
Wouldn't it be easier to put an experienced crew back on the ship?
Galloping around the cosmos is a game for the young bones, replied Shatna.
What's that supposed to mean? Said Uhura.
Shatna turned to Uhura. Bones is my new nickname for McCoy. You're probably used to me calling him Boner, but...
No, said Uhura. I was asking what you meant about commanding a starship being a game for the young. You were weirdly young to be a captain. Most captains have gray hair and look like Professor X from the X-Men film.
Shatna looked annoyed at the comparison, so Spock jumped in.
Bill, I got you a present.
He gave Shatna a book.
I know you like antiques.
Shatna looked at the book.
Nice, he said, holding it up to his eye like a sextant.
No, it's a book, he pantomimed reading. Shatna opened the book.
Dickens. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Message, Spock?
None that I'm aware of, just that it's your birthday. Surely the best of times. And one of the main characters sacrifices himself for the greater good further in. Maybe that's foreshadowing of some sort.
Oh, that kind of spoils it, doesn't it?
No, people like to read it for the jokes, even if they already know the plot.
Well, thank you, Spock, said Shatna, putting the book under his arm. He and Spock said goodbye and headed off to their respective shuttles.
Shit, it's Bill's birthday,
said Bones when they were out of earshot.
What kind of shops do they have here on the space station?
Uhura shrugged and looked down the corridor.
There's an optician?
Wow. That's just about the worst gift imaginable.
One chapter in, and this podcast is already better than 80% of those murder podcasts where the boyfriend obviously did it, because it's always the boyfriend. I don't even know why they're dating. Anyway, thanks, Chrissy. You know, it takes more than superstars like William Shatner and Ricardo Montalban to make a movie. It also takes hundreds of people working thousands of hours behind the scenes. So, in each episode of The Novelizers, we're going to meet one of those people and learn about their incredible ability to make movie magic. But, since they're not superstars, I'm just going to let my intern Kevin talk to them. Kevin, how are you doing? So who'd you talk to today? And when are you going to pick up my dry cleaning?
Sure thing, Andy. So, in a later chapter of Wrath of Khan, Chekhov gets a mind-controlling slug placed in his ear by Khan. I wanted to know more, so I talked to Will Hines, the on-set slug consultant.
Great. I can't wait to hear that. And also to get the dry cleaning.
Hey, Will, how's it going?
Very good, thank you.
Thank you for being here. Andy wanted to, but he's not, so it's me. So let's get right into it. What made you want to be a slug wrangler?
Well, it was sort of love at first sight. When I was a little kid and I'd be out in the rain jumping in puddles, I'd see slugs after a storm and I just loved them. Found myself to be kind of a science geek, and I eventually just chose to focus in on being an expert in slugs.
Every person, I believe that when you have something that you enjoy and that you love to do, there's a certain moment in your life that you say to yourself, I want to get further. I want to learn more about this. What was that moment when it came to you for slugs?
I was taking the SAT when I was a senior in high school, and there's a part where you have to fill out what you believe your major will be if you go to college. And I wrote down chemical engineering, and then I just, you know what? It's a lie. That's just what my father wants me to do. It's not what I want. And I took my pencil and I erased it, and I wrote in its place slug expert. And I was like, that feels right.
So when you said something about your dad wanting you to be a chemical engineer, how does he feel now, or how did he feel then about, you know, so you making his decision, especially, you know, as it come back with an SAT saying you want to be a slug expert?
My father always wanted me to be a chemical engineer. When he found out I wanted to be a slug expert, I was eventually disowned. I was initially barred from Thanksgivings and then asked to remain silent at Christmas. And then eventually I was as barred from the home as a bad influence. I have two younger brothers who are both chemical engineers. Mm-hmm. And I'm the black slug in the family, such as it is, the rogue, the rebel.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry to hear that.
He said, get out of my house. He said, get out of my house. If you're going to pursue a useless profession when you could have done a perfectly good one, his, get out. You know, working on Wrath of Khan, I think Ricardo Montalban reminded me of my father. You know, sort of a control freak, a tyrant, open shirt fashion,
yep.
Dominant, but intelligent, intelligent, clever, charming. My father was all those things. I was brought to tears by Ricardo Montalban's performance many times.
We can dig deep. It seems like there's some parent issues there.
No, I don't think so.
You know, you don't think so?
No, I'm totally resolved. I'm 100% great with it.
Okay, just making sure, because you just said that the guy who played Khan was reminded you of your dad.
He did, very much. I was like, that's when I first got to set and I saw Montalban, I said daddy and started crying. But I know this sounds weird, but that's because I'm over it. Because I'm in touch with those feelings and I'm not suppressing anything.
I love, you know what I'm saying, interviewing people like this because I realize we have connections, you know what I'm saying, and we have similarities. You know, my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Okay.
And I told them, no, I want to be a star. You know, I want to go to LA and I want to write. I want to direct.
I hear it in your voice. I'm like, if you told me that you were a doctor, I'm like, no, this guy's meant to be in the arts.
And
he's meant to be in front of the camera.
Thank you. And, you know, 10 years later, I'm Andy's intern. So fuck you, mom.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the process? Like, what was it? How did it happen? How did you get this job to be the slug ringer for this movie?
After I had done my PhD in slug personalities, I was referred to a couple of people writing sci-fi stories who wanted just to check the veracity of their slug info in their stories. Then word got around to various monster films in the late 70s. But my big break was I worked on The Empire Strikes Back. I was referred to George Lucas, and he brought me on set to be a consultant for a deleted scene where Han Solo fights a bunch of giant slugs. It ended badly because I insisted the slugs would not attack Han, and I asked that it be taken out. And, I'll say this. George took it out. He respected that he was all about reality, emotional reality, and he took it out. But I also was fired and told that I was not allowed to visit future Star Wars sets.
Oh, wow. You can't win them all, you know?
That's what I say. You can't win them all. I was like, hey, this is the way it works out. But that did lead to me getting other work on movies. I worked on Raiders. I worked on Kramer versus Kramer. I worked on, and then eventually Wrath of Khan.
Cool.
Yeah.
Was there any, this is, you know, the listeners like to hear like behind the scenes stories, you know, good stories about what it's like.
Oh,
you know,
sure. So
is there any stories that you can tell about Wrath of Khan, you know, that viewers may not know about?
Shatner hated the slugs. Shatner, I hate to talk badly about a man who I think is a terrific performer and a great actor, but he had no empathy for slugs. He'd make fun of them. He'd kind of bully them. And it was cruel. And I was like, hey, you're not allowed to do that. He said, make me. I'm number one on the call sheet. You can't stop me from. And I was like, all right, listen. Then I finally said, okay, well, you're interfering with the quality of the scene if you agitate these slugs. And he did respect that. He didn't want to hurt the scene.
So how did you feel when Shatner shot one of them and, you know, disintegrated one of the slugs?
It drove me nuts. I hated that he got to win, you know, And I petitioned for one of the slugs to have sort of a moment of victory over mm-hmm. Shatner. I pitched that maybe one of the slugs could, you know, win him over, mm-hmm. you know, make him get humiliated by the other slugs. But, you know, the writer pointed out that that would add like 15 minutes to the film.
So it seems like what you were trying to do were trying to make the slugs more of the star of the film. Is that what you're trying? Do you want the slugs to be stars?
No, that is not what I was doing. I just wanted them to be accurate, okay? I was lied to. I signed on the agreement that slugs would be portrayed accurately. And I was like, they were like, yes, we want it to be accurate. And then I got there. And they're like, well, what is this crawling into people's ears and turning them evil? They would never do that. You know, mm-hmm. a shrimp, maybe a cockroach for sure. But a slug, it's just insane. I mean, I was like, this movie's going to get laughed out of the theaters if you do this. And so I don't need them to be the star, you know, mm-hmm. One or two scenes, you know, maybe something in the final battle or whatever. Not, you know, that's not my expertise. I'm not a story guy.
In the movie, you know, after they, after the slugs had came out of Chekhov's ear, mm-hmm. and like he, you know, because they killed Chekhov. So right now, I know, you know what I'm saying, they need to be good guys, but right now they're known for killers. Slugs are known for killers.
Within
right
the reality now. Of that movie, they're incorrectly shown as being killers, yes.
Okay. But you know what I'm saying, sometimes movie percepts real life sometimes, you know what I'm saying? So I just want to let you know that, but I understand.
Oh, believe me, I know it, and I hate it. I you know, I quit mid-scene when I realized that's what was going to go down.
Oh, wow. You quit. So what mid-scene, how did that happen? What happened?
I said, cut the action here. This is wrong. And I was reminded that I'm not allowed to call cut. And I apologize. And I went up to the director and said, hey, what's going on here? This is bullshit. And they were like, you know, again, these are not real slugs. And I'll say that despite how things ended, those guys did try to do the right thing by me. And they did refer me to other jobs. But I noticed they mostly referred me to movies where slugs get killed in huge numbers.
In this movie and in a lot of other movies, the slugs are never, you know, they're never, according to you, they're never respected for who they are as
slugs are almost, know? Yeah. One thing that upsets me is slugs are never portrayed as good guys, which they are. Slugs are good. And that side of slugs is never shown in movies. And I've made pitches, Die Hard, you know. Hans Gruber's coming around the corner. He's got a gun pointed right at Bruce Willis. And then from the ceiling drops right on his eyeball, a slug. And he goes, ew, gross. And his arms are waving around. Bruce Willis can run up and take the gun out. You know, that's the kind of thing where I think that would actually be pretty easy to work out. I made a pitch for Beverly Hills Cop 2 for Eddie Murphy to have as his partner, a slug. I could see some teasing too. I wouldn't be above, you know, Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Getting the slug's goat a little bit. I think that would be on character.
You know, so we're going to end it there. Thank you, Will, for interviewing and being part of this. We appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this interview portion of The Novelizers. I have been Kevin Carter with Will Hines. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Fascinating interview, Kevin. Our second chapter was novelized by Josh Leib, who's written for The Daily Show, News Radio, What We Do in the Shadows, and The Simpsons, and narrated by H. John Benjamin, star of Bob's Burgers, Archer, Family Guy, and more. John Benjamin, engage.
Chapter 2, Dr. McCoy. Novelized by Josh Leib. Narrated by John Benjamin. These are men. Kirk is a man. Kirk opens the door to his solo pod and acts like he's surprised to see me. Why, bless me, Doctor. Can the vaudeville, I sneer, as I fight the urge to bend down and weep on the hem of his command pants. I shove the packages into his hands. Happy birthday. Kirk unwraps the bottle first, thank Nebulon. His eyebrows arch. Wiebelfeltzer sweat, he says. That's illegal in this quadrant. When did you grow a uterus? I rasp as I reach, not too greedily, Bones, for the jug and pour us each a slug. Kirk looks at his leerily. He says, you know they have to drown the Wiebelfeltzer in its own mother's milk as the mother watches to extract the sweat. I leave exobiology to the pointy-eared freaks. I down the shot and smack my lips. Damn, that Wieb goes down smooth. Like the ad says, you can taste the fear. I reach for the bottle and pour myself another slug. The Wieb always helps. I put my glass to my lips but pause when I notice Kirk is watching me. Testing me. He's always testing me. I stare back at him as frankly and as blankly as I can muster. Admiral James T. Kirk. Last of the Rocket Boys. I want to tell him that he's fat, that his hair looks ridiculous. I want to tell him that he's my hero. I slug down the Veeb and tap the smaller box. This might be more to your liking. Jim's eyebrows stay arched when he opens it. I've seen these before. They're antique. They're called, pornography? Reading glasses, I correct, glorying in this moment. They're tough to find with the lenses still intact. Good, old-fashioned 20th century know-how. Most of men your age get a Globulax injection to deal with short-sightedness. I'm allergic to Globulax, he says, in exactly the tone I imagined. Like, offhanded. Like it meant nothing to him to admit this allergy, this weakness. Oh, but I know how much it must pain him. I manage to keep my poker face, but deep inside me, my intestines writhe into a twisted smile. Kirk claps me on the shoulder. Thanks, Bones. Then a cloud passes over his noble brow as he crosses to the living room suite. I grab a seat next to him and put on my best doctor voice. What ails the Admiral? Kirk doesn't answer me, not exactly. He stares out the window at New Frisco and wheezes tunelessly under his breath. I grow old, I grow old. I should wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. What the hell is that supposed to mean? I snap before I can stop myself. Is he making fun of me? Am I so small to him that he can converse to me in riddles? He turns to me, the eyebrow arches back. Just a little more 20th century know-how, Bones. A poet who is facing much the same dilemma I am today. I never cared much for that long-haired cack. He puts down his glass of Veeb. He still hadn't tasted it, and looks at me wryly. What do you care for, Bones? The smug son of a bitch. Is he trying to make me cry? Is he trying to make me care? I don't cry, and I don't care. You have to be hard. You have to be merciless. You have to be empty. Oh, but he's got that superior look, that godlike look, boring into my soul. I've seen that look before. They'll make a man out of you here, says the old man at the gates of the academy. They'll make a man out of you, or don't bother coming home. I did my best. I washed my hands. You're Starfleet's problem now, nerves. Bones, says Kirk. Bones, are you all right? Of course I'm all right, I bark. I'm always all right. Then I notice the blood dripping down my fingers, the shards poking through my palm, where I'd squeezed the glass of Veeb a little too hard. I staunch the bleeding with a napkin as I pull out the fragments. Damn glass must have slipped, I muttered lamely. Are you in pain? Asked Kirk. I don't feel anything. He hasn't taken his eyes off me. This isn't how it was supposed to go. He was supposed to be impressed that I'd gotten the Veeb. He was supposed to admit his weakness, his fragility, when I gave him the spectacles. He was supposed to look at me for advice because I am hard and I am merciless. Now he's going to laugh at me with the other men. Scotty and Chekhov and Uhuru and the pointy-eared freak, goddamn him. Old Bones is losing his bottle, they'll smirk. Old Bones is going soft. But he's not smirking now. He's feigning concern. I'm worried about you, Bones. He's worried about me? It wasn't supposed to go this way at all. I finish mending my hand and shoot him a wry grin. There's nothing wrong with me that a good long shore leave wouldn't fix. His frown deepens. Bones, you're on shore leave. Stop trying to change the subject. I have to take control. I have to steer this back. He needs to be molded, sent, propelled. I need to be trapped with this man in a ship, in the vacuum of space, without the infinite distractions of a civilian world, where we can do our jobs and wear our uniforms and make our wry comments, where we can be bonded in bloodlust against Klingons and Daleks and the Rebel Alliance, where we can be men, damn it, and go back to our berths and bolt the airlock and cry ourselves to sleep at night. I lash out wildly, hoping to hit upon the right formula. Admiral, I intone, heal thyself, proving I grok a little at that long-haired cack myself. His brow wrinkles. He's confused. Is it working? What's that supposed to mean? It means your concern for me is clearly projection, a sick perversion of your fear of your own mortality. He sinks back into his chair like a wounded ape. My Ford, he's so wrapped up in his self-imposed torture that he's actually buying it. His weakness is showing. It pokes through, raw and pink and wet, like mange on a tribble's anus. And what would you prescribe for this condition, Doctor? This is what I've been waiting for. This is my moment. Get back to your command, I tell him. Get out there and do, and act, before you really do grow old. He thinks, then he stares out the window again. I know I've gotten through to him. Doesn't feel as good as I thought it would.
Spectacular. Well, I don't know about you, but my mind can't handle any more top-notch literature today, so let's put a bookmark in it, and I'll see you next time with all new chapters narrated by Felicia Day and Andrew Daly. Kevin, land this spaceship.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks to this week's guest contributors, Christina Chong, Josh Lieb, H. John Benjamin, Ross Powell, and Will Hines. Links to their fabulous books, swag, and cameo accounts can be all found in the show description. The Novelized was created by Stephen Levison, produced by Stephen, Chris Karwowski, and Rob Kuttner, and edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Karwowski. Music by Cole Imhoff, Andrew Land, Mike Wilson, and Chris Messing. Chrissy Chong was recorded at Soho Sonic Studio in London. Special thanks to Lizzie Price at Independent Talent, Sarah Mabe, Crystal Dennis, Kelsey Steinkamp, Dennis DiClaudio, Dustin Marshall, and Hannah Levinson. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and Twitter at The Novelizers or visit thenovelizers.com. The Novelizers is a work of parody unauthorized by Paramount, Roddenberry Entertainment, or Star Trek. I'm Kevin Carter. See you next time.
Thanks, Kevin. Novelizers out.